The Invocation by D. Vincent de Palo. Movement 2. Chapter 1. Istanbul. The following summer, after Paul's graduation, the three of us went on holiday to Istanbul. It was Paul's treat, his graduation present to himself. By that time, I was used to his generosity, but this trip was far beyond anything he had offered before. As much as I delighted at the prospect, I felt uncomfortable accepting such a gift. I half-heartedly begged off, citing work and health issues. In truth, my foot was not well suited to sightseeing, but he saw through me quite easily.
"You can't refuse this, Surin, if only for the Hagia Sophia. Isn't that your holy of holies, your Mecca?"
He had me there. Istanbul was Byzantium herself. I still had one more year at university. If I were to finish in 3, as Paul had done, a very real possibility if he kept waking me in the middle of the night with his humming and whistling. And being there, with the Hagia Sophia, the Byzantine Great Palace, the Hippodrome of Constantinople, and so many other lesser-known cathedrals and churches, with who knew how many masterpieces painted and mosaicked on their walls, would be invaluable for my dissertation. In any case, the alternative wasn't very appealing. To spend the summer alone in steaming London, for Emma was determined to visit Italy on her own for research if I didn't agree on Turkey. It was eventually decided in Paul's favour, of course, and he breathed a sigh of relief as he handed us our tickets, already purchased at an exorbitant fee, for the Orient Express. We embarked from Paris on a stifling Bastille day, the air rank with the undisguised stench of the French as we hurried along the platform, handed our luggage to the porter, and climbed up the steps into the blue and gold carriage, passing from our stifling noisome world into a gleaming wood and polished brass interior. A vision of old world splendour, though an old world gloriously cooled by modern air conditioning. Paul took a single, while Emma and I shared a sumptuous double cabin. They were adjoining. We could open the intervening wall to create a lovely drawing room, but they were wonderfully private too. The rhythmic drone of the engine and constant hiss of the wheels effectively creating a muted cone of silence around each berth. Indeed, Paul spent most of the trip proofreading a score of his, a commission for the Austrian Radio Symphony. He found the white noise and gentle rocking of the carriage an aid to his concentration, the perfect antidote to the cacophonous distractions of metropolitan London. He was an old hand at first-class travel anyway, completely inured to the novelty of its pleasures. Emma and I, on the other hand, were like kittens in a cotton field. We couldn't get enough of the enchanting treasures, the 3 individually styled restaurant cars. Lalique, Étoile du Nord, and Chinoise. The boutique, Le Périgord. The bar car, where black tie and ball gown were the norm. And the beautiful landscapes of France, Switzerland, and Budapest flying by. A constantly unfolding movie framed by double-paned, highly polished windows, a glass of champagne and a Tiffany lampshade the only constant, a gentle reminder that this motion picture was, now and forever, exclusive to the sumptuous blue and gold theatre of the rails. The passage alone would have been vacation enough for me. But then we arrived at Circeci Terminal, a gratifying mix of Ottoman and European artistry, complete with elaborately framed windows set in Prussian walls of 3-foot-thick granite, and I felt my heart leap with joy. The air was thick with the scent of spice, slow-cooked lamb, tobacco, fresh herbs, and the sea. I looked across a field of minarets and there, rising from the earth like the skullcap of Emperor Justinian, was the Hagia Sophia herself. My eyes blurred. "Thank you, Paul. Thank you." He smiled down at me.
"No, thank you, my friend, for coming."
In the taxi, I kept blurting out names. Top Carpi Palace, Hippodrome Square, the Galata Tower, and Emma just chatted with the driver, never turning to see what I was hollering about. She knew how long we would be staying, knew she would see it all eventually.
"You smoke, yes? We trade."
She handed over her Dunhills for a worn sack of Turkish loose leaf. There was no question why I went. It was for the art. And as soon as she'd experimented with it, it was clear that Emma was there primarily for the tobacco and those communal pipes they smoked it in. Paul was harder to pin down. He had grown up in Bad Gastein, a small skiing village in Austria, and had visited Istanbul many times in his youth, so perhaps it was simply an obvious choice for him. In fact, the caretakers at the villa did seem to know him, though I couldn't be sure. Not understanding the Greek, they used to inform him of the building's particularities. You could only flush the downstairs toilet in the morning when the cistern was full, for instance. However, based on his ensuing activities, Paul either came for the coffee, the brothels, or the baths. It was the perfect city for our little trio. At night we'd roam the cobbled streets, nightjars murmuring their quiet song, the soft bubbling of countless hookahs gurgling through the warm, scented air, and decide where to eat, in a restaurant, a cafe, on the water, in a garden, or just sitting on a bench and eating a kebab while we watched the tourists and locals pass by, all equally entranced by the singular quality of light, air, and place itself. We tried to stay together, but often found that Paul had an appointment for a massage or bath. He seemed to truly enjoy being naked in public, to stand there, all exposed, even out of the water, and have long animated conversations with strange men, themselves naked, aged, and often touching themselves as they spoke. I went with him once, but could hardly make it past the changing room. The horrible scene of an enormously fat Turk being helped out of his clothing by a young boy wearing only a golden codpiece, so sickening me that I nearly retched. I was more fascinated with the city as a living piece of history, as Constantinople, than as a temple of earthly delights. I could sit anywhere in the whole vast sprawl and find something to arouse my interest. It was a particular and not uncommon joy of mine to wander into a church and find one of the very frescoes or mosaics I had been studying in my book shining down upon me in breathtaking detail, like walking into the Cora Church, for instance. I'd known of it, of course, but I wasn't prepared to see the Virgin and the Child staring down at me from the northern dome of the inner narthex in such vivid colour. To see that expression on her face, the crushing presentiment of her newborn child's fate. It was astonishing. But on those occasions we did find ourselves together, the itinerary was left up to Emma. She loved to walk, her long, graceful legs so light on the unyielding stone. Her feet never became sore, her ankles never swelled, her knees never buckled from the awkward strain of a misshapen tendon on uneven masonry. Paul sweated profusely, and must have lost a stone. I struggled and cursed my foot more times than I can recall. In the end, however, after all the effort and discomfort, we were always grateful for Emma's prodding, for we had seen it then, whatever it might be, and felt that much the richer for having done so.
"Will you try to incorporate the Turkish sounds into your music, Paul?"
Emma asked during one such excursion. It was already a week into our vacation. We'd just left our villa in the Golden Horn and were on our way to meet a guide who promised a private tour of the Hagia Sophia. As we'd passed through Taksim Square, we'd stopped to hear two wonderfully talented musicians, one playing the oud, a kind of fretless lute, and the other a ney, an end-blown flute of hollow cane. The music was very beautiful, with strange quarter-tone harmonies and asymmetric rhythms. Paul had dropped a handful of liras in the open oud case as we'd left. It was when we had cleared the noisy square and were climbing toward the Galata Bridge that Emma had broken the silence. Paul considered her question for a step and then said,
"I don't write what I hear around me, my dear. The music comes from within."
He knocked on his head just as three old women in black burkas shuffled silently past. He bowed to them, knocking once more, and they ignored him with icy disdain. Emma watched them go, then said,
"But surely you must admit these sounds are quite intoxicating."
She took a deep drag of her cigarette.
"As is this delightful tobacco."
Paul laughed.
"Emma, you are so verdierbt. It really is quite amazing, a girl of your talents. Anyway, I only meant that I don't pay attention to sounds so much as tones, or, more specifically, chords and their relations to one another. In any event, while I freely admit that music exists all around, that I simply find it, I believe the music was here long before man came to the earth, long before Constantinople was built, long before the oud and the ney were invented. So no, although I find myself inspired by the city and the people, I won't try to incorporate the local color. I'm not a modernist after all. I'm not interested in representing the world as we've made it. Machines, random chaos, everyone talking at once. No, it's something I hear inside me that I attempt to get out, that I'm always attempting to get out, as a matter of fact, and never quite succeeding.
Like a dog with a flea above the base of its tail?
Emma asked, an arch expression playing across her delicate features. Paul smiled.
You could say that.
Just then we passed a small mongrel licking himself with such evident gusto that we stopped as one and bent in hysterics, shocking the poor beast out of his pleasure. That was one of those perfect summer days, the sky so blue it seemed cut from a vein of purest tourmaline. We had to walk quite a bit further than we'd expected to meet our guide, almost to the limit of my endurance, and when we'd arrived we'd been informed by his wife through antic gestures and pantomime that he'd either been struck on the head by a large bird or had given birth to a goat. Yet even that hadn't dampened our spirits. We rested at a corner as Emma redrew our route and decided a new itinerary. An old man with a huge cask of chai strapped to his back came trudging past, and we bade him stop. He siphoned tea into three dirty glasses, and we drank greedily, feeding off the caffeine and sugar in the revitalizing brew.
Are we far from the obelisk of Theodosius?
Emma asked. The old man squinted, his face cracked and lined like a dried fig.
Çok güzel,
he said, smiling and refilling her empty glass. I flipped through my little dictionary and translated, Everything is beautiful in life. We eventually found our way. In truth, it was hard to miss. And while Paul and Emma sat smoking in the shade of an olive grove, I studied the hieroglyphs on the ancient pillar. There's something to be said for being part of a three-way relationship, a certain solidity that can never be achieved when only two souls are involved. Emma and Paul and myself were all so comfortable with one another and with our respective positions in our little group that none ever felt left out or ignored. Just as the Bosphorus divided the city and connected the Black Sea with the Sea of Marmara, so our little triangle divided us while it simultaneously held us together. Therefore, it was not an awkward feeling I had, leaving Emma and Paul to sit alone while I peered myopically at the inscriptions. I had no misgivings about Paul's treatment of Emma, or of Emma's treatment of Paul, nor even of any romantic attachment. There was none. But had there been, I felt sure I would have accepted it with equanimity, as a way of paying back Paul's generosity, perhaps, or as a kind of charity to one afflicted with so embarrassing a condition as his. Yet, as I knew with total conviction, I had nothing to worry about on that account. However, I was troubled that day, that perfect summer day as I stared at the ancient phallus, and I couldn't put my finger on it. There was just a strange confluence of history and art and life in that city. Things which seemed no more than coincidence or serendipity, but which, when looked at from a distance, took on a pattern. Of course, at that time, I had no distance, so I couldn't see it. But I was feeling it. Something is not right, I muttered, staring at the base of the monument.
Yes, it is missing there. A piece,
a man said through a heavy Italian accent.
The obelisk was moved in the 4th century from Luxor, and the bottom was perduto, lost.
He seemed very proud of this fact. His chest filled, as if he were inhaling the truth of it through his nostrils.
Forgive me,
he said after a pause.
I am Roberto, from Milano.
We shook, and I could feel the hair on the back of his hand under my fingertips. For some time we stood in silence, gazing up and shielding our eyes from the sun. It was uncommonly bright. Eventually he coughed and looked around.
I come on holiday,
he said, as though in answer to a question.
But I am music lover too.
I see, I mumbled, not looking at him but at the obelisk, hoping my words might be taken as a private comment from a man lost in thought, as well as the just barely polite response to his statement.
What I mean to say,
he continued,
is that I saw you and your friends earlier. He is very great composer, no?
Paul was a great composer, sure, but he wasn't internationally famous yet. perhaps in England and his native Austria, but not internationally, not yet. So this piqued my interest. This was one of those things, you see, something that was not right. But I didn't know it then. Yes, I said, relieved now that I understood the man wasn't interested in me, per se, but only because of my relationship to Paul. Yes, he is Paul Schoenfeld, the greatest living composer, if you ask me.
Schoenfeld. Yes, Schoenfeld,
he said, mouthing the syllables, breathing them in and out and tasting them in his curious way. We both looked over to the bench, and Emma, bless her heart, gave us a little wave. Roberto became very animated.
See there, he cried. The lovely girl, she comes to us. We go there now?
He was like a little child, so excited. Yet I hesitated. He had such very strong cologne, and his arms hung so low by his sides.
But she waves. She calls to you. No?
His voice trailed away. Very well. Come along then, Roberto. I'll introduce you. I began to walk, but he stopped me. He hurried around the obelisk and came back with my cane, handing it to me apologetically. Yes, of course, thank you. Emma called to us before we were under the shade of the olive grove.
Who's your friend, Soren?
Emma, this is Roberto.
Molino,
he said with a bow.
Is that a fact?
Paul said under his breath, half standing and offering his hand.
I'm Paul.
Roberto took Paul's hand in both of his, keeping hold while he sat eagerly by his side.
Yes, I know. Your friend was telling me. Yet I thought it was you even before. In fact, I have heard your music. I have heard your Trio of Despair.
That sent a jolt through my system. I glanced at Emma, but she was smoking and smiling politely, enjoying the spectacle for much the same reason I had at first, because it was happening to Paul. It came to my mind that the trio had been broadcast on BBC One, along with another piece, a quartet by Carlo Molino, the two being the split first prize winners for the Elgar competition. I could see that Paul made this connection too, for his face immediately clouded at the recollection.
In fact, I was listening because of my cousin, Carlo,
Roberto continued, oblivious to Paul's sudden stiffness.
He was also on the performance, the string quartet, Carlo Molino.
Yes, I know,
Paul said, and a gurgle sounded from the depths of his stomach.
Carlo sent many programs to Italy. You look just the same as in your picture. I tell you this now, in secret, eh? But you must promise never to tell.
He looked expectantly at Paul, but receiving no reply, went on.
I enjoyed your trio much more. There was no comparison. My cousin, Carlo, it is like the grinding of the coffee. No? I don't understand it, but I am no musician either, so I say nothing. And he is very well rispettato, see? So I believe his must be good.
Paul glanced at me, and I offered a non-committal shrug. It wasn't my fault. Roberto had approached me out of the blue.
I agree,
Emma said through a cloud of smoke.
I could barely sit through that second movement. Such screeching.
The judges seem to like it, though,
Paul said. I shook my head. Please, only because there was nothing remotely similar to it in all recorded history. They had no frame of reference. Roberto smiled broadly. We were on his side.
But it is a secret, yes? Our secret between friends?
Yes, of course, Roberto,
Emma said, leaning over and patting the swarthy Italian's knee.
We won't ever tell, will we, boys?
Paul and I both dutifully shook our heads, but Roberto didn't notice because he was standing up and gesticulating wildly. Then, to my horror, and Paul's too, no doubt, the little round head of Carlo Molino came bobbing around the obelisk, his small yellow teeth flashing in the sun. You have been listening to The Invocation by D. Vincent De Palo. Follow along with the book, available in the Kindle store. See the link in the show notes. And do stay tuned for the next chapter.